You're listening to TalkZone.com. Internet Talk Radio.
TalkZone.com.
Pro Football Weekly and Basketball News.
Hi, Hub Arkish, along with Jimmy Clemens and Mike Wilkening, welcoming you to this week's edition of Pro Football Weekly and Basketball News, where every week we bring you all the news, scoops, and rumors before they happen from the National Football League, the NBA, and college hoops as well.
We have the latest NBA coaching carousel news, plus all the latest way we hear it from around the NFL.
It's all just ahead on Pro Football Weekly and Basketball News.
Pro Football Weekly and Basketball News!
Welcome in, one and all. I'm Hub Arkish, the publisher and editor here at Pro Football Weekly and Basketball News, and I am joined by my co-host, senior editor Mike Wilkin, and of course, every week of the basketball season, our co-host Jimmy Clemens of the LA Lakers is here. We've also got our very favorite NBA and college basketball insider, Steve Kyler, the publisher of HoopsWorld.com, for the very best inside information about basketball at any level. You want to get to HoopsWorld.com, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And Jimmy, I'm going to hit you with it first. We are taping late on Thursday. We're getting ready for a tip-off of Game 4 between your Lakers and the Celts in a couple hours. We'll get to that in a few moments. But we're also wondering, is Tom Izzo going to visit Dan Gilbert in Cleveland because he's serious about taking this job? Is it a done deal? Some people in Lansing are saying that it is, and yet I sit here scratching my head and say, why would Tom Izzo do this unless he had an ironclad guarantee that LeBron James was going to be back as well?
I have no idea. I wish him well if he decides to jump into the fray. It could be the, you know, the lure, the challenge. Who knows, you know, what the next thing that I want to conquer as a coach or throw my hat into the ring. But I certainly, if I were as successful as he is at Michigan State and the collegiate level, I'd be like Mike Krzyzewski. I would just stay there.
Well, Steve, the one thing we know is that he's amongst the top tier of college coaches in the 2.2, 2.4 million a year range in Lansing. Allegedly, the Cavs are talking in the neighborhood of 6, maybe even 7 million a year, a 4 or 5 year deal. So the money certainly can be compelling. But again, if he inherits a franchise without LeBron James, how is he going to compete?
Well, I think some of this is just, you know, response to admiration and certainly Dan Gilbert being a Michigan State alum. You know, I think part of this is just showing some respect and giving it the look. I mean, you know, Tom Izzo has made it clear that if he won another championship at Michigan State, he'd consider a job in the NBA. So it's not like we're hearing from Coach K where it's, I have no interest, no desire. I think that Tom Izzo's already made it clear he has an interest in coaching the NBA at some level. And when you've got a 5-year guarantee, $6 million a year, an owner who's going to go out and spend $100 million a year to be a champion, is committed to being a champion, you know, that's going to be something you probably have to look at. And I think that, you know, Dan Gilbert has probably said, look, if we don't get LeBron, we're going to do a sign-and-trade, and we're going to get other assets back, and we're going to be very aggressive in building a winner around it, around this team if we don't get LeBron. So I don't necessarily buy into the idea that there's, you know, already some kind of a wink nod that LeBron's coming, because, you know, LeBron's made it pretty clear he's not ready to make that decision. But, you know, when you go on Larry King and you tell Larry King Cleveland's the front runner, you've got an owner like Dan Gilbert, you get a coach like Tom Izzo, I'm not sure LeBron's going to find a better situation than that in the free agent market. And I think maybe Tom Izzo knows that too.
Well, and Jim, you got to ask yourself the question, because the one thing Steve said, which I understand and I agree with, if the owner's going to spend $100 million to compete, he's got a chance. But you can spend $100 million. If you don't get one of those 5, 6, 7 key guys, of which LeBron is one, you know, it doesn't matter what you spend. And we're already beginning to realize that with all the free agency frenzy this year and all the names, you know, LeBron James and Dwayne Wade and Amari Stoudemire and Dirk Nowitzki and Chris Bosh and on, there's a very good chance that Chris Bosh is the only one who ends up moving. So the willingness to spend money doesn't guarantee that you're going to have a competitive ball club.
Willingness to spend money never guarantees. I remember when I was in New York and Steinbrenner was spending money on the Yankees like a drunken sailor, and he had an all-star at every position, and the Yankees still didn't win a championship those 2 years. It's chemistry, and it's guys' willingness to play selflessly in order to get the job done. So those owners out there and general managers say, well, I can get an all-star here, I can get an all-star there. All-stars don't make winning teams, and I think by and large, when you have that much talent, guys grow up thinking about themselves more than the team, and I think it's a poor combination. But once again, I think you get these owners, and they think that money, throwing money, good money after bad money, is going to give them a winner, with more power to them. But it's not true in sports.
Steve, if Tom Izzo, in fact, leaves East Lansing, Michigan to go to Cleveland, does this trigger a chain reaction in big-time college basketball like we saw in 03 when Roy Williams left Kansas to go to North Carolina?
Absolutely it does. And you know, you have to wonder when you've got a program like Michigan State that's already kind of earmarked $2-3 million for a head coach, if they can't get some former NBA coaches to come running. You know, it wouldn't surprise me to see a Mike Brown in that discussion. I think that whenever you see a marquee position open, and Michigan State is loaded from a talent point of view with the team they already have in place, you put the right head coach in, and you're a tournament team. There's no question. And there's a chance, you know, they could be a Final Four team as constructed. So I think there's a lot for Tom Izzo to really consider in this. But I also think if you're Dan Gilbert, and maybe you've already gotten the inkling that LeBron's not coming back, and you've got to rebuild that franchise from the ground up, I can't think of a better architect than Tom Izzo.
All right, gentlemen, we're going to take a quick commercial break here. Lots more NBA Way We Hear It as coaching jobs open and fill. We've got it just after this quick commercial break. Hub Arkish, Mike Wilkening, and Jim Clemens bringing you Pro Football Weekly and basketball news. We are joined by the publisher of HoopsWorld.com, Steve Kuyler. And, guys, Avery Johnson, Mikhail Prolakoff decides that he's the guy to rebuild the New Jersey Nets. And Jim, I start with you. I'm a big Avery Johnson fan, but one of the reasons he's been on the sidelines the last couple of years was a little prickly, a little set in his ways down in Dallas. Is he the right guy to rebuild a young, growing basketball team?
Well, I think that New Jersey is going to be one of those franchises. It's kind of sitting there, and the owner, as we said in the last segment, the owner has money. He's willing to spend it. So I think the New Jersey Nets that we saw this year are going to be a far different look than the team that Avery's going to coach next year. So I think with free agents and trades and so forth, it's going to be interesting to see who he coaches. But I think that with the owner willing to spend money, he's going to have a much improved basketball club.
Well, and Steve, no arguing with what Jimmy just said, but we do know he's going to have young Lopez, and he's going to have, what, the third pick in the draft this year to build around, regardless of what veterans they bring in. We know he's going to coach good defense. Will he get along with the younger players?
Well, you know, it's going to start with team captain Devin Harris, who, you know, they know quite well. You know, the whole reason that Avery Johnson was out in Dallas was because he was unhappy about Devin Harris being traded, so it's a reunion of sorts. He's got a great young two-guard in Courtney Lee who loves defense, loves discipline from his coaching position. You've got some upside kind of guys, and guys like Terrence Williams. You mentioned Brooke Lopez. You're going to get the third overall pick, which is probably going to be Derek Favors from Georgia Tech. So you're talking about a team that, A, has hit the absolute bottom, so they have nowhere to go but up. He's going to get a couple of years to kind of shape the team the way he wants the team to play. And, you know, as Coach will tell you, his Lakers team is sitting where they're sitting because defense wins championships. And, you know, Avery's a great defensive mind. He's a great defensive coach. I think he brings in the right kind of assistant coaches that can help kind of soothe some of the gruffness that can be Avery Johnson. And he brings in the right kind of assistants. I think he can be very successful there.
Wilkie, let me ask you quickly. In Chicago, the worst-kept secret in the NBA is the Bulls have hired Tom Thibodeau to be their head coach, who, according to my sources, was also offered the Hornets job by New Orleans, told them he was going to wait for Chicago. Now, in the NFL, this couldn't even happen because Tom Thibodeau is still coaching defense for the Boston Celtics. Any fallout from this, you feel, as far as the Celtics go, the fact that their top assistant and associate head coach is already on his way out the door?
Certainly the Celtics were open to him interviewing for the teams. I don't think there's any fallout there. New Orleans reportedly had interest. A very valuable member of that staff, had a lot of experience. We've all heard Jeff Van Gundy speak very highly of Tom Thibodeau. He's a lot of experience. I think certainly he's ready for this job. I would think Boston, you know, will be able to replace him with a capable assistant. And from the Bulls' perspective, they're getting somebody that clearly is put in his time and, you know, is going to be at the helm of a very young and exciting team and, you know, a team that could make a big splash in free agency.
Jimmy, the Hornets have hired Monty Williams, the outstanding assistant from the Portland Trailblazers. Now, if my sources are correct and Thibodeau did turn them down first, what kind of spot does that leave the Hornets in as they now have to, you know, honestly say, hey, we got our second choice. We couldn't be happier.
I've known Monty since he was a high school player, and I was trying to recruit him out of the Washington, D.C. area. Wonderful person. Basketball savvy, very intelligent and bright. I couldn't be happier for him. And this might be the time for his rising star to really shine.
I've got to come back to you, Steve, with the Atlanta Hawks, because they're puzzling me right now. They have yet to hire a coach, as all these other jobs fill, theoretically, with the top options out there. If the Hawks can bring Joe Johnson back, which I understand is a big if, they've got as talented a roster as anybody in the Eastern Conference. What do you think the Hawks are waiting on?
Well, it's really been kind of, they started this process with their general manager, Rick Sund, and a lot of their front office staff, and they kind of whittled through this, and they've really interviewed everybody. They interviewed Tom Thibodeau, they interviewed Avery Johnson, they've interviewed Mark Jackson, I think now three times. Dwayne Casey, the assistant from the Mavericks, has always kind of been the front runner, but current Hawks assistant Larry Drew was brought in and met with ownership, and there's kind of a real discussion going on that maybe Larry Drew is the right guy for them. He's familiar with all of the players, as you said. You know, they're trying to kind of pick up where they left off, and a lot of people are making the Alvin Gentry, comparison that, you know, having familiarity means you don't have to start over. It just means you can maybe do some things a little bit better. And, you know, Larry was able to come in and really explain to ownership and to management how he would run things. And I think it was enough to get him at least neck and neck now with Dwayne Casey. And ultimately, I think it's probably going to be Dwayne Casey, but right now it does look like it's a two-horse race between current assistant Larry Drew and Dwayne Casey, and Larry Drew's made a good, strong push here down the stretch.
Steve, let me ask you quickly before I let you go. I'd love to ask Jimmy this question, but I don't want to put him on the spot. It's about the L.A. Clippers. Reports that David Geffen has expressed an interest in buying the majority interest from Donald Sterling, thinks he can attract LeBron James, people putting one and one together and getting two, saying why LeBron would go to the Clippers. But Sterling has said the team is not for sale. Is Donald Sterling the problem with the L.A. Clippers, or is it just that they're always going to be number two in that market behind the Lakers?
I see that Donald Sterling was part of the problem, but I think over the last few years, and certainly under the Mike Dunleavy era, you know, Donald has spent money. He's given out contracts, and some big contracts. You look at the contract that Baron Davis is currently playing under, that's probably one of the worst contracts in the league. You know, Chris Kaman's been well paid. They've gone out, been very good in drafting. You look at how that team has amassed young talent, whether it's, you know, Eric Gordon, whether it's Blake Griffin, who's yet to play his first pro game. They're in a very good position, but, you know, there are just some franchises in Sports Hub, and, you know, living in Chicago, the Cubs can't ever get it right. The Clippers just never seem to get the lucky bounce. And, you know, I think they're a team that's really poised to do well. They're in the market for a head coach as well. I think that's going to be a big decision on which direction this franchise goes. And, you know, it was just a matter of time before somebody found a way to make the Clippers a viable candidate for LeBron. Over the past 3 weeks, we've heard a pitch from every team that could have a run, and you had to wonder how the Clippers were going to be viable. And here it surfaces. It's David Geffen, and he'd love to own 51%. But, you know, as Andy Rozier, their team president, said, they're really not interested in that scenario. And I think a lot of this is just about trying to connect the dots to how LeBron is viable as a Clipper, wherein I think the reality of it is it's just not going to happen.
Steve Kyler, the publisher of HoopsWorld.com, I would have promised you he'd all be back next week till he got his Cubs shot in at me. He'll be back next week anyway. We take a quick break, and we'll talk Lakers and Celtics with Jimmy Clemens in a moment. We roll on with Pro Football Weekly and basketball news. Again, folks, we tape late Thursday every week. We're airing in over 100 markets around the country at different times over the weekend. In order to deliver the show on time, we must be on tape. So we are a couple hours away from tip-off of Game 4 in the NBA Finals between the Celtics and the Lakers. And, you know, Jimmy, you look at the last two games, and you've got Ray Allen setting an NBA record with 7 first-half threes. The team, 11 for 16 from beyond the three-point line. The Celtics steal Game 2. You guys go into Boston, steal Game 3, and Ray Allen is scoreless from the field, 0 for 13. It can't be that simple, can it? There's got to be more going on than just whether Ray Allen is hot or cold.
Well, I tell you, his shooting performance in Game 2, even though he was an opponent, or is an opponent, I should say, it was one of the best shooting performances I've seen in my athletic career. And I told friends afterwards that you have to give credit where credit is due, and he was just marvelous from the field. That being said, they need his outside shooting to stretch our defense. And in game three the other night, it just wasn't there. Even though he got many of the same shots he'd hit in game two, it just wasn't his night. So we have to find a way to neutralize his offensive output, as well as Glenn Davis off the bench and Rasheed Wallace. Those are the two matchups off the bench that bother me. But Ray's ability to stretch the defense and Fish's staying out of foul trouble guarding him is a real concern of ours.
Jimmy, after game three, did anybody grab Powell in the locker room and say you might not want to tweak KG again?
Well, the fact is, from what we got, the whole conversation that was reported in the press was somewhat convoluted. It wasn't exactly, Powell was asked one question, and then as he responded to it, as it was given out to the press or presented in the press, and I guess on video, it was a whole different set of circumstances. So he did take exception to how it was presented because that wasn't the question that was posed to him and how he answered it. But that being said, they've been trying to get Kevin off early in all three of our games thus far. And we expect in game four tonight that they will do the same. And he has to be ready for they need an inside presence. They need someone that can keep our defense close and attack the basket. And Kevin obviously is a choice. Perkins, we know, is a very good rebounder and defensive player, but they don't go to him for offense. So if they're going to get offense in the middle, it has to come from Garnett. So there's no doubt behind it. Powell has to be ready to play outstanding defense and stay out of foul trouble, as that's been our nemesis in game two. And we had problems with that early in game three.
Well, and Mike, the interesting thing about this conversation is we figure out what the Lakers have to do defensively and what the Celtics have to do to put points on the board. Paul Pierce's name hasn't been mentioned. The MVP of the 2008 Celtics Championship Series has been somewhat invisible.
Yeah, you struggled a little bit these last two games, played well in game one. I think that when it comes down to it, he's certainly a big part of what they're doing offensively. We talked about Allen at the outset. And, you know, when he's hitting jump shots as an offense, that's very good. And certainly, you know, obviously Rondo being the straw that stirs the drink, so to speak, in terms of that and the triple-double. When this offense is hitting on all cylinders and all of those things, it does look very good. There are times, though, where things break down. Pierce has struggled a little bit. But that said, you would think he'd be on his game, you know, be able to bounce back the rest of this series. But the Lakers, you know, have done well here defensively against him.
Jimmy, the and one that Derek Fisher put up on the layup just under a minute to go in game three with three Celtics, including Kevin Garnett and Big Baby all over him, was one of the greatest plays I've ever seen. And you ask yourself at some point, when are people going to stop calling him a journeyman, you know, extra guy and realize what a key part of your ball club he really is?
History will have to write that. I've been extremely blessed over my coaching career to be associated with a lot of fine basketball players, but Derek Fisher is a fine human being. So I'm quite sure that one of these days people will give him credit for not only being an outstanding basketball player, but I tell you, you won't find a better person. I couldn't have been happier for him the other night in the locker room, because if it weren't for his heart and desire, we would have truly lost that game. There's no doubt in my mind. But he found a way to dig and get the job done. And that's a credit to who he is as a person.
Jimmy, quick question before we let you go. I'm guessing with this West Coast, East Coast series that you may not mind the 2-3-2 format because it only causes the two trips. I don't like it. In any best of seven series, I grew up with 2-2-1-1-1. Any preference for your ball club?
Well, it's extremely tough and difficult. If we were to drop all three games here, then once again, you know, I talked to some other friends earlier, where's the home court advantage? It does make it easier on travel for the traveling parties and the media included, and I think that's why it was started in the first place. But I'm with you. I think that 2-2-1-1-1 it doesn't exaggerate the home court, but that's the way we grow up playing in the other two series, and in the finals we go this 2-3-2 format. And if you lose all three games at the other site, you're definitely behind the eight ball.
All right, Jimmy, we wish you the best of luck tonight and this weekend in Boston. We can only pull for a well-played, entertaining series for all. We're going to make the switch to football in just a moment. NFL, way we hear it, coming up next.
Football Weekly and Basketball News.
And it is time here at PFW and Basketball News to talk some football. We've got NFL Way We Hear It, and we start by welcoming in Associate Editor Michael Blonda. And Michael, you know, some would have thought last year when Scott Pioli and Todd Haley got to Kansas City that maybe the best young player on that roster was wide receiver Dwayne Bowe. And it has been a weird relationship from the beginning. Bowe not exactly focused, and you have to wonder, has Todd Haley and Pioli had enough?
Yeah, it's been an interesting situation with Dwayne Bowe. I mean, really no player has given them more trouble in their tenure there than he has. He's easily one of the most talented guys they have. But, you know, first he shows up overweight for last season's OTAs, then really displays kind of a lackadaisical attitude in training camp, then goes on to get suspended 4 games for taking a diuretic to, you know, in an attempt to drop the weight that he was being accused of gaining, and then drops 11 passes during the season. So all that, you know, has not really sat very well with the coaching staff, and he's really running out of chances with that team, even though he is, you know, easily their best receiver.
You know, Michael, it's interesting. Todd Haley is a guy, I got to know him a little bit when Todd was the wide receiver coach with the Bears and I was broadcasting their games on the radio. And I really like Todd. Nice guy, a very likable guy, but very volatile and a guy who would go off at any time. And that reputation, if anything, grew as he got into differences of opinion, shall we say, with Terrell Owens in his days in Dallas, and he had problems with various players in Arizona. Now he's the head coach. And doesn't seem to have changed all that much. I mean, is he one of the more popular guys in this locker room with his players?
Yeah, it certainly doesn't sound like, you know, from what I hear, it seems like a lot of guys in that locker room certainly had issues with them, or still do. I think they got rid of some of the guys who, you know, weren't really big fans of his. But a guy like Jarrett Page, who still hasn't signed his restricted free agent tender, is rumored to really not be a big fan of Todd Haley, which is one of the reasons he is still holding out. So, It's a strange relationship with him and the players. It's going to be interesting to see if things change this year now that he is more focused on being the head coach and not also calling plays. But it's certainly not a usual relationship between the head coach and the roster.
The Chargers kind of have an interesting situation at kicker. Nate Kading is the incumbent, hit 32 of 35 field goals in the regular season last year. But as we all know, 0-3 in the playoff loss to the Jets, then had a groin injury, had surgery in the offseason. What's his outlook entering 2010?
Kading surprisingly, seems to have kind of put this out of his mind pretty quickly. It seems like this is the kind of thing that could really dog a kicker for the rest of his career, to miss 3 makeable field goals in a big time playoff upset loss. And then it didn't really help that he went on to injure his groin in practice for the Pro Bowl and had to undergo surgery. But he's back on the practice field, got back on there in May. And he seems to be doing all right. He's facing questions about, the disastrous performance, speaking openly about it to reporters. And it seems like he's been able to kind of get it out of his mind and get ready for 2010. You know, he was the leading scorer in the league last season, so he had a really good regular season. Just that one, you know, playoff hiccup kind of has been stuck in his mind for a while. But it seems like he's been able to put it out, and he's ready for the start of a new year.
Michael, thank you very much. We're going to ask you to hand off the mic to Associate Editor Arthur Arkish now. And Arthur, in Jacksonville, just 2 years ago, 3 drafts ago, Derek Harvey drafted 8th overall in the first round. And it wasn't just the Jaguars. Most teams had him about there on their draft board, thought to be the future of the pass rush. It's been a colossal disappointment so far through his first 2 seasons, just 5.5 sacks. In the second round of that draft, they took Quentin Groves. He's already been traded to the Raiders. Their former Pro Bowler at tackle, John Henderson, was released this offseason. Talk about a make-or-break situation for Derek Harvey. How is that shaping up for the Jags and Harvey right now?
Well, so far this offseason, Harvey actually looks pretty good. He shed about 15 pounds when he arrived for the first round of OTAs a few weeks ago. His playing weight is down to 265, and they're excited about his leaner physique. They think that it should add some quickness, and it should hopefully give him a bit of an edge when it comes to getting to the passer.
Arthur, Aaron Kampman is a guy that everybody in the NFL should have wanted, and they might have if he wasn't coming off ACL surgery. How has he looked so far? Are they confident that he's going to be 100% to start the season?
He looks good so far. He's got a long way to go, obviously. He tore that ACL last November. So it's still pretty fresh, but they are hoping that he is going to be full go by training camp. And with his work ethic, as we all know, he's going to do anything he can to be ready and on the field. And they are they're optimistic that he will be there.
All right. Thank you very much, guys. We've got a lot more NFL Way We Hear It to come. We're going to take a quick commercial break, and then we're going to go NFC South in just a moment. More NFL Way We Hear It right here on Pro Football Weekly and Basketball News. I'm Hub Arkish along with Mike Wilkening, your hosts each week, and we now welcome in Associate Editor Dan Parr. And Dan, in the NFC South, the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, young, rebuilding football team, Josh Freeman, they hope is going to be the answer at quarterback. If you want to give him a shot, you got to protect his blind side. And while Donald Penn may not be a household name, he is their offensive left tackle. He's a restricted free agent. He has not signed his one-year tender. And apparently general manager Mark Dominic has now been reduced to making threats.
That's right. He sent him a letter, actually, informing him that his salary could be cut $100,000 if he's not signed his restricted free agent tender by the June 15th deadline. Now, the Bucs would like to have Donald Penn next season. Donald Penn would like to have a long-term contract offer from the Bucs, and it doesn't seem like they're really interested in doing that, negotiating that with him at this time, and he's been staying away from OTAs to show his displeasure with that. Now, Donald Penn, like you say, not a household name, but he's done a pretty nice job the last few years, and Mark Dominic was instrumental in finding him and bringing him along earlier in his career. There's a pretty good chance this will, you know, settle well for everyone, but maybe not as well for Penn as the Bucs, but I think he's going to show up eventually.
It just seems to me, Dan, that it sends the wrong message. You've got this young quarterback. The left tackle should be his best friend for the next 4 or 5 years. They kind of like Penn, and yet, you know, why not lock him up long term? This may be an opportunity, if you think he can play, to lock him up at a bargain basement rate.
It's a pretty good question. We're not sure what Penn's demands are right now. He may be, you know, asking for a whole lot more than would be sensible. But a lot of teams are taking this tact right now with their restricted free agents. A lot of general managers are sending these letters to guys who have not signed the restricted free agent tenders who want long-term deals. It's not coming. The rules have changed with this uncapped year. Teams are under no obligation to get deals done. And then with the uncertainty about, you know, next season, what's going to happen with the lockout, they don't want to commit a lot of money at this point. And the Bucs certainly seem like they're one of those teams.
Switching gears, Dan, and kind of staying on the subject of contract issues, Darrelle Revis, the Jets corner, you know, might be the best player at his position in the game. Missed some time in OTAs earlier on, you know, to kind of express displeasure with his contract. He's back at OTAs. Give us an update. Where are the two sides with regards to a long-term deal?
Well, it doesn't seem like there's been a whole lot of progress made to getting that done. The Jets apparently insulted Darrelle Revis with their first offer, and I haven't heard anything to suggest that they are closer now to getting something done. I don't know if there's any kind of timetable for when things need to be done. I'm not sure if they set that up, but Darrelle Revis did return to OTAs after sending that message a few days ago by skipping a session. We don't know if he's going to be at a mandatory mini camp coming up next week. That will probably be a sign of where things are headed.
You know, it's interesting with the Jets, Dan, no team has been bolder during the offseason and the moves they've made, and yet Pro Bowl center Nick Mangold, also very unhappy, could be a holdout in training camp, and you have to wonder, can the Jets afford to be making these big commitments and then have current stars who've already gotten them to an AFC title game so unhappy?
Yeah, Nick Mangold has been outstanding at center, and to have him out for an extended period of time in training camp would be another bad development for the Jets. They really can't afford to have things go sour with these two players. So it's going to be interesting to see how they kind of work out the money situation with these two guys. They're going to cost a lot, and I'm not sure the Jets really have the money or want to spend the money right now after all they have done in this offseason.
Dan, I promised NFC South news very quickly. Two other clubs for the Carolina Panthers. Horrible news. Weak side linebacker Thomas Davis tears his right ACL for the second time in 7 months during OTAs, almost certainly done for 2010. This has got to be somewhat devastating for the Panthers now that Julius Peppers has moved on.
Yeah, this is a big hit for them. They're going to hold out hope that he'll be ready to play the second half of the season. They might put him on the PUP list to start, but we know it takes a while to come back from ACLs, and when two happen in a row like this, it's a big concern, and it really has a dramatic effect on the linebacking core. There's reports out of, you know, Charlotte that they have really made a big change and moved John Beeson to the weak side. And then we're going to move Dan Connor to middle linebacker and have James Anderson on the strong side. So that's a real new look for them. Beeson, could do it. Probably will do a good job at weak side, but he was outstanding in the middle. And when you take a piece like that and move it out of there, it could have some major effects. So the Panthers' defense is a big question mark.
Jonathan Babineau, one of the unsung heroes on the Atlanta Falcons, did a nice job for him last year at defensive tackle. Nothing but problems off the field. He has been charged with possession of marijuana with the intent to distribute in December of 2009. Team waiting to find out about any suspension, and is causing a real problem for the Atlanta Falcons.
If they're without Jonathan Babineau for the early part of the season, that defense is going to have a real tough time, especially up the middle. That the personnel, they have a little bit more depth there than they did. They spent a pick on Corey Peters. They signed him already. They want him not to miss any time because he could be playing a major role early in the season, and we're not sure he's prepared for that. So something to watch.
And the Falcons actually successful in putting Michael Vick in their rearview mirror. They're going to be very, very impatient with any more off-the-field problems with Mr. Babineau. We've got a commercial break here, and then we go NFC East and AFC North. Our NFL Way We Hear It rolls on with senior editor and soon-to-be host and co-host of the show, Eric Edholm. Eric, you had a couple interesting conversations this week. Got to visit a little bit, I understand, with Donovan McNabb and got to talk to him about his stable full of just short of Hall of Fame, almost certainly over the hill running backs in Washington. I mean, look at what they've got there. Clinton Portis, they've got Larry Johnson, they've got Willie Parker, and they've got a contract offer on the table to Brian Westbrook. Do any of these guys have much left in the tank, and what are they going to do with this collection?
Yeah, I guess you could accuse Mike Shanahan of living in the past here. If this was 2006, they have a Hall of Fame backfield here. And, the Westbrook contract offer is pretty interesting. Obviously we'd reunite him with McNabb. Donovan spoke very sort of, I'm not sure what Brian's going to do. I mean, he didn't say a lot about it. Didn't glean a lot on the subject. So, it's interesting. Some people think that Larry Johnson may actually be the favorite here. Portis hasn't been shown a lot of love by Shanahan, his old coach. He once traded him in Denver. So I would think if Westbrook came on, Willie Parker might be the guy who's sort of left out. He's kind of the speed guy, but he kind of lost something last year. So, very interesting situation. People even forget about Ryan Terrain, who looked like a breakout star a couple years ago before a knee injury.
All right, and I know you also had a chance to have a conversation. I can't call him the heir apparent. He's the heir in Philadelphia. Kevin Kolb has taken over. Kolb had anything to say about life after Donovan? Any comments about McNabb and what it's going to be like replacing him?
Yeah, both guys are really complimentary of each other. And there was this sort of thing, I guess the word schism now can be used in football, but everybody wanted to kind of drive a stake between these two guys. Donovan seemed a little testy when Kolb was drafted, but, Kolb said, look, he sat down, he worked with me. He didn't try to pull a Brett Favre. He actually, taught me what he knew and what he learned. So I think they had a very mutual respect for each other. Sure, they weren't going out and getting beers together, but they were two good teammates for the duration of that. And Kolb feels very confident right now. He's had a great offseason. He's looked great in minicamp and OTAs, and he's throwing the ball really well. I talked to Brent Celek this week, who said he's throwing the ball now and looks more confident than he ever has. But he looks back at those two starts last year and was really glad that he had that experience, because without him, there'd be a lot more questions. Even though it is only two games, I think people would really be harping on that lack of experience.
Derek, I am a huge Andy Reid and Joe Banner believer. They've done a remarkable job with this ball club through their decade-long tenure. But I believe this could be the trading of McNabb, one of the great cases of premature ejection in history. And does Kolb really grasp the shoes that he has to fill here? Donovan didn't win a Super Bowl, but look at what he did do.
Yeah, absolutely. I think he does have some perspective on it. And I said, look, I asked him, I said, this is one of the toughest jobs in sports, even if you weren't replacing a legend. He said, look, I understand what I'm walking into. And he's a real quiet guy. He lives a little bit out in the country. He's married to one of his, youth sweethearts, and his only youth sweetheart, and just kind of leads a nice quiet life. That's about to change. He knows that. The perspective has completely turned on its head for him.
All right, Eric, thank you very much for your work on those stories. I want to come back to Wilkie here in studio now. And, Mike, one of your ball clubs, the Baltimore Ravens, and I find this story fascinating. They have been caught, apparently, by the NFLPA and the NFL League office with, let's just call it, practicing too hard, and they're going to be penalized. They have to give up their final week of OTAs. This is the second NFL team in the last week penalized. The Raiders were just penalized two OTAs. Apparently, this is something you almost get the feeling it may be partially the Players Association watching, picking on everything they can with the hard CBA negotiations going on, and some of it may just be that the league office has said it's time to follow the rules.
And here's an instance where a grievance filed by the NFLPA and resolved by the NFLPA and the NFL Management Council. You know, the Ravens have taken accountability on it. Head coach John Harbaugh, also general manager Ozzie Newsome, you know, have stepped up and have said, hey, it was a mistake. And, you know, as Harbaugh said, when you make a mistake, you step up. They lose 2 days of special teams drills next week. John Harbaugh's background is in special teams, so certainly that's not the most pleasant thing for them. But in looking at this situation, Chris Carr said something interesting in the Baltimore Sun, and just paraphrasing here, that there's no animosity between players and coaches at this point. I think that the key here for the Ravens is that you fix whatever went wrong in terms of the time, in terms of the policies, you fix it, and you move on as a team, and you don't let it linger. I think that's the biggest issue here. If it doesn't linger, then it's something nobody will remember anything about here beyond this summer.
All right, Mike, thank you very much. You wonder if it's the University of Michigan story all over again. Everybody's doing it, but the Ravens and the Raiders got caught. We take a commercial break. The Publisher's Pen is next.
The Publisher's Pen with the publisher and editor of Pro Football Weekly, Hub Arkish.
Mike, thank you much. And you know, there was a story in the NFL that really flew under the radar this past week as the Stanley Cup Finals came to an end and the NBA prepared for games 3, 4, and 5. The NFL Players Association Executive Director DeMaurice Smith has filed a complaint with a special arbitrator challenging the NFL's TV contracts and saying that basically what the owners did in negotiating these contracts was conspire to get the major TV networks to help them force a lockout in the 2011 season. Now, the point of contention is that the contracts currently in place state that even if there is a lockout, the owners will receive approximately $5 billion in cash flow from the TV networks. Now, if that happens and they don't have to pay their players, every team would make a profit during a lockout. But here's the problem, guys. That's not guaranteed new revenue. That's an advance. It's just cash flow. At some point down the road, that money would go back to the networks and fees they wouldn't pay out in the out years. So that clearly was not the NFL's intention. Maybe smart negotiating to cover their behinds, but you got to wonder, what is the NFLPA doing? It is those television networks that have got them the huge increases in salary in recent years. Coming off a huge victory with the Supreme Court ruling against the NFL, I'm just not sure what DeMaurice Smith is doing here. That's going to do it for this week's edition of Pro Football Weekly and Basketball News. Our thanks to Steve Kyler, the publisher of HoopsWorld.com. Randy Myers, our engineer and executive producer, does such a great job for us every week. Syndication Networks, our home studio and syndicator. And most of all, as always, our thanks to all of you, our listeners. We appreciate you being there. Please tune in again next week, same time, same station, for Pro Football Weekly and Basketball News.